Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Within marriage is a promise to stay committed to a spouse through all the changes that can happen in a lifetime. But for Diane Daniel, those changes went further than she ever imagined. Anne Dowd, who recently won an Emmy for her performance in Hulu's drama The Handmaid's Tale, reads Diane's essay, "My husband is now my wife."
The alarm went off at 4 a.m. on a Tuesday. My husband and I had been told to arrive 2 hours early, as if for a flight. My eyelids were puffy from the night before, when he had held me and said he was sorry, so very sorry. I'd wept without warning after dinner because I would not see his face again, his perfectly average face with a sizable nose and weak chin, the face I'd held and kissed and been happy to greet for 8 years. "Do you still have your wedding ring on?" I asked. They said to take it off. We'd married in our 40s, both for the first time, our independent lives blending seamlessly. "Oops, yes." He twisted the ring off his slender finger, and I placed it in a beaded box on my dresser. We'd bought the box in Bali, one of our many adventures. On that trip, we shared crazy hot meals, hiked up volcanic mountains, and stayed in a grungy room that housed a large lizard, a fact my considerate mate did not reveal until we checked out. My protector. My pal. My prince. Here we were again, exploring new territory, headed to a place where we knew a few customs and words, but were not fluent. As he backed out of the driveway, I thought of the checklist and asked, "You didn't drink water, did you?"
"What do you mean?"
"The pre-op instructions. How much did you drink?"
"About half a cup," he confessed.
"Unbelievable," I huffed. We rode in silence, anger masking my fear. I focused on my breathing, on letting my affection return like a ripple moving toward the shore. "What are you feeling, hon?" I put a hand on his leg, returned to the person I usually am with him. Stupid for not reading the directions. It's better than feeling afraid. We were told the operation could last 7 hours and recovery several more, so I came prepared, like I was on a trip, packing my laptop, phone, magazines, a blanket, and a pillow. He checked in, and a nurse led us to a room where she checked his vitals, all excellent. His water transgression was deemed acceptable. He checked in. His transgression. Still, on this day, when my husband would take his first surgical step into womanhood, I continued to say him, his, and he, even though our therapist had suggested for months that I use female pronouns at home. "I will when I need to," I told her on our last visit, "but for now, he's still a man to me." I turned to my husband, dressed in jeans and a black button-down shirt. "When I look at you, hon, I see a man." "But she's a woman," our therapist countered, her words slicing through my denial. "Not to me," I said with wet eyes. I crossed my arms like a willful child,
I can accept that he'll become a woman, but he's still a man now.
How do you feel, hon? Do you really feel like you're a woman now?
I've told you before, yes, I feel like a woman, he said with an apologetic look. And so the time when I need to had arrived. We were at the hospital for facial feminization surgery, a not uncommon procedure in male-to-female transitions, in which a surgeon carves out a more femininely proportioned version of a male face. In my husband's case, this meant higher eyebrows, a smaller nose, and a more pronounced chin. A few months later, his Adam's apple would be shaved down, and he would get breast implants. Genital surgery would follow. Already, estrogen had narrowed and softened his face, and the alterations would be slight, the surgeon said. His wide blue eyes would not change, nor would his high enough cheekbones or soft lips. Our history of openness, affection, and trust had kept me believing that our relationship would survive, even thrive. I never felt my husband had deceived me, as some friends suggested. He had told me early on that he was ambivalent about his maleness, but had made peace with it. Having conflicted feelings about men myself, the macho sort, I hadn't realized the depth of his confusion. It wasn't until we were married that my husband, finally feeling loved, admitted to himself that he was transsexual, that he was, inside, a woman, that he did not want to be the man I married. Stunned and wounded, I located a therapist, read transgender books, found support online, and confided in the lone friend I had entrusted with my secret. My husband and I continued to talk, to love. Over time, I came to believe that my husband, as my wife, would in most ways be the same person. Intelligent, compassionate, mature, with the same slim build. I'd had a relationship with a woman in my early 20s, so living as a lesbian was agreeable enough, though I mourned the societal ease we would lose. In the pre-op room, I pulled my chair toward my husband's gurney. He was sitting up, shoulders stooped, feet hanging over the side. I buried my head in his chest. The curtain moved and his surgeon appeared. Good morning, she said cheerily. Seeing her outside her office jarred me. Surgery was no longer a plan, but an event. I started to cry, softly, politely, but I really wanted to wail and sob. How do you grieve for someone you've lost, but who is still there? She took a surgical marker from her pocket and sat opposite my husband to draw black dots on his chin, nose, and forehead. When she was finished, he looked like a warrior. She left us alone, and I took his hand in mine, my eyes now dry, while his filled with tears. What's going on, hon? I asked. I'm sorry for all the pain I'm causing you. Tears smudged the dots under his nose and rolled down his face. I know why I'm doing all this, but it's just crazy, isn't it? He said. And I regret all the years I felt so isolated. I wonder what I missed. Try to focus on the courage you're showing by doing this at all. The nurse returned. It's time to go. Your husband will be fine, she added with a smile. The outpatient waiting room was crowded with people anxious to hear about their families, friends, lovers. As I do on airplanes, I took a window seat. I saw that the day had dawned gray and rainy, with gusts of wind. I overheard conversations about heart attacks, cancer, hip replacements, but nothing about gender transitions. Starting today, I would be a minority, an oddity, the wife of a transsexual woman. The notion exhausted me.
I passed the hours reading and emailing updates to the small circle of family and friends who knew about the operation. Our official coming-out email would be sent the following week. The surgeon, all smiles, stopped by to let me know everything had gone smoothly. A few hours later, a nurse took me to my wife. To her. Those terms I must start saying. Her bruised face was compressed with bandages, while another strip of gauze was taped under her nose. She was groggy and hurting. After he eats a little something, we'll give him pain pills, a nurse said.
Could you say she? I asked gently.
2 hours later, as the sun set, we headed home. I'd reclined her seat, propped my pillow under her head, and laid my blanket over her. I drove carefully, placing my hand on her knee whenever I could. When we reached the house, I asked if she minded staying in the car while I tended to the pets, knowing our entrance would be chaotic otherwise. She nodded yes. The house was warm, but I turned the heat up to make it toasty. I imagined my life if the person in the car didn't exist. Easier, but empty. I returned and roused my dozing partner, spouse, wife. We shuffled inside and into our bedroom, which I'd stocked with her medications, ice bags, and gauze. I maneuvered her under the covers and fluffed her pillows. I took her wedding band from the beaded box and slipped it over her finger. It was 7 p.m. and dark. The post-op instructions advised patients to sleep alone to protect their noses from thrashing arms, but we could not imagine being apart on this night. I placed a sleeping bag on my side of the bed and zipped myself in. Every few hours, I'd get up to hand my fitfully sleeping spouse more ice packs, pills, water. We'd been in bed almost 12 hours when a gray light filled the room. Still under our covers, we were warm and safe. Soon enough, we would face the world. I pulled my right arm from the sleeping bag and took my partner's hand. We stayed like that, side by side, until the sun rose on our first day in this foreign land.
Anne Dowd, reading Diane Daniels' essay, My Husband Is Now My Wife. Now, you may have heard Anne get a little emotional while reading Diane's essay. She says the words made a big impact.
What this author has done is to get to the core of what love and acceptance and trust is. And I don't know how human beings can speak those words without a struggle, because it's so deeply personal and real. And so it was a privilege to read it.
Anne Dowd. You can see her in The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu. So what happened to this relationship? More with Diane in a minute.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at The New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Welcome back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Diane and her wife, Lena, are still together. They now live in the Netherlands, Lena's native country. And while a lot has happened since that first surgery, Diane clearly remembers the day this journey began, when Lena told her that she identified as a woman.
As soon as she said it, I knew that my life would never be the same. And I ran, we were at the table, I ran to the couch, which was like maybe 20 feet away, and like hurled myself on it and just started bawling. And she was really horrified and felt awful, like she had no idea that she would hurt me so much.
It's not that Lena was insensitive, Diane says, but they had very different emotional reactions to the idea of a transition.
Probably the biggest thing that's so difficult is that the transitioning person is elated with the process, scared and also somewhat sensitive to the people around them, but also very excited and very proud of themselves, as they should be, to deal with this huge issue in their life. For them, it's like a birthday. And for people around them, it's like a funeral of the person they knew. And even though the person is still the same, you're still losing. I mean, I was losing my husband. And so that part was just gut-wrenching.
But Diane was not angry with Lena.
I mean, there was that cliche when I first found out, like, this is not what I signed up for. But come on, nothing is what we signed up for. This one might be a little extreme, but I couldn't really be angry at someone for being themselves. I mean, she never manipulated me or lied to me. She was always honest at the time of whatever was going through at that time. I mean, her development unfolded. And so I couldn't be angry. I'm sorry.
It was hard enough to come to terms with Lena's gender transition privately. Then she and Diane had to figure out how to talk about it with people around them. In Durham, where they lived during Lena's transition, friends and family accepted them with open arms. But things got complicated when they left home. One experience shortly after the couple moved to the Netherlands made Diane reconsider how open she should be with new people.
An American woman just sort of checked out. It's funny, because we were so embraced in Durham, my reaction was, are you kidding me? Like, you know, it's 2015. What is your problem? But I was also sad and hurt and didn't really know what that meant for the future. So for the most part, I don't say anything. I don't want them to be uncomfortable. I don't want us to be uncomfortable. And I just try to just be aware of what I'm thinking and not beat myself up over it at all, but also not sort of become a victim to this, what are people thinking?
And you can guess what people are thinking, or at least wondering, a lot of the time.
Sometimes people will just flat out ask me about our sexual relations. And then usually my answer is, well, you tell me all about yours first, and then I'll share some of mine with you. And then they realize, well, I'm not going to talk about that. Although I totally understand that it's a normal curiosity. I have the curiosity about many couples, whether they're straight or gay or whatever. But what is so much more important is really how you love and how you treat each other. And in the end, that's all that matters, is how you are with each other.
Diane says her marriage has a strong core. And that's what's helped it endure.
What we have is a very sweet, intimate, romantic relationship. We share tons of interests. We have a great time together. And I just cannot even imagine being with anyone else.
Diane Daniel. She lives in the Netherlands and writes regularly about her experience on her blog. You can read it at shewasthemanofmydreams.com. Coming up, some thoughts from Daniel Jones.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Dan Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, explains what he found most valuable about Diane's essay.
It takes you into the detailed sort of emotional transition of her thinking of him as a man to, in her mind, being able to think of her then as a woman. But it's really a testament to what they do share, that they can start out on one side of this experience and come out the other side with their relationship stressed but intact, and their love stressed but intact, and how important that is to both of them.
Thanks again to actress Anne Dowd for reading this week's essay. Next week, Kimberly Hebert Gregory of ABC's Kevin Probably Saves the World and HBO's Vice Principals. She reads an essay about an attempt at erotic talk gone awry.
One rule of thumb for marriage would be to avoid imitating Julia Child's voice during sex. I learned this lesson one Sunday afternoon while fooling around with my husband. I recently had bought the book, The Fine Art of Erotic Talk, by Bunny Gabriel, and I was up to Chapter 5, Fantasy and Role Playing.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Additional sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Megan Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.